Friday, May 27, 2022. This is The Better Life. I'm your host, Timothy Lawson. Living a better life means making your bankroll work for you, something I've done recently. Just last week, I looked at my bankroll. I looked at all the ways that I like to bet, and I kind of made a list of priorities. Well, I guess I kind of had one sort of unofficially, but this time I actually put pen to paper and wrote down, what do I like betting? What am I good at betting? Looking at my results, where is my ROI? What are the best ways to get money down? The best ways that I like to use promotions or free play. And using that, I am able on a daily and weekly basis to put my bankroll best to use. A good example here, and this isn't the extensive list, this isn't all-inclusive, but just to list three sort of buckets right now. First, USL, right? Everybody knows, whether you are sick of hearing me talk about it or you're all about it, whatever, doesn't matter. I know that I'm good at betting the USL. That's where I focus my money on any given day or week. Next on that is tailing action from people I respect. When Gil puts out his tennis picks, when I hear Drew Dinsick or Andy Mulder or someone that I respect put out an opinion, Jason Weingarten, when I hear them mention something in a show, whatever it may be, boom, I have a certain unit size that I will put on that. And then the leftovers are arbitrage, right? And so I have a handful of markets where I'm confident I can find arbitrage between certain books and stuff like that. And so I will spend once I know I have my handicapping done, and I know that, and you know, usually by that time I already actually have sort of my tailing stuff in. Okay, now I can round off the day by applying a bunch of arbitrage, and I'm going to sort of use up the rest of my bankroll for the day and wake up the next morning and sort of rinse and repeat. And what this does is it makes sure that I am prioritizing my bankroll and how I want to apply my bankroll the best. And where this really comes in handy is once USL started, I actually sort of pulled back betting other leagues in soccer because I didn't want to tie up my money as USL lines were coming out, right? So when USL lines drop the morning before the games or the day before the games, I wanted to make sure that I had as much of my bankroll available to start firing as I needed. And that has made sure that I'm able to lose less and hopefully win more long term. So I think that's a really good exercise for anybody who takes sports betting seriously. Know how you want to use your bankroll, not just in what you're betting in this moment, but you know what the opportunity cost is in if I tie up, you know, this part of my bankroll. If I know that a league or games or a market that I can beat or that I feel good about is coming out tomorrow, or I anticipate making a bet soon, I don't want to tie up unnecessary bankroll with stuff for this weekend or posting other bets or stuff like that before I know I can get that action down. And look, that's going to be different for everybody. Look, I'm not a professional, but these are things that I do to stay disciplined and stay focused on ways that sports betting is fun, efficient, and you know, good for me. This week, talking to Rufus Peabody. This episode is a long time coming. We first brought this up, I think, summer of 2021. Yeah, it must have been last summer. It was shortly before Bet Bash that the original Bet Bash, not the one recently in Vegas, but the original Bet Bash that was in Jersey City. It was a little bit before that I'd finally connected to Rufus and proposed having him come on The Better Life. He was all for it. We talked about it again. We were at Bet Bash, and we talked about it again when we saw each other in Vegas not too long ago. And it just sort of never really happened. And then, you know, NFL, Super Bowl, March Madness, Masters, and finally I decided now's the time to reach out, especially because Rufus has gained the reputation in the sports betting and gambling Twitter and his community for being someone who is forthright about his mental health and what he does to address it and take care of it. And so I thought that he made a very fitting final episode to this series of mental health. We talk about ego, we talk about discipline, we talk about therapy, so much more. I really hope you enjoy this and get something out of it. Fired up. Rufus Peabody, professional sports bettor. You and I have crossed paths a few times, it feels like, in the past 6 months in New Jersey and Vegas. And each time we say, hey, we should do a podcast. And then there was a thing called the Super Bowl that I think had a couple of us busy, and then March Madness. But it all ends up working out because May is Mental Health Awareness Month. And I know it's something that's important to you. It's important to me. So I think it just sort of, we'll call it kismet, that that you and I were finally able to connect here in the month of May. But Rufus, we are, first of all, welcome to The Better Life, sir. It's a pleasure to have you.
It's a pleasure to be on. Thanks for finally like getting this together. I mean,
long overdue. Let's start these interviews where we start all of my interviews, and that is your first exposure to gambling. Can you recall that early in life where maybe you weren't the one betting, but like you would just remember being around it?
So my first exposure to, well, so okay, when I was in elementary school in second grade, I had, I don't know where my parents got it, a green t-shirt that's a Las Vegas t-shirt. So that's my first experience, I guess. But actually I remember in the Washington Post, they would have the point spreads for, in the sort of scoreboard section each day for the NFL games. I remember the home teams were listed in capitals and the lowercase or like all caps, underdogs, lowercase. And I remember seeing those and, you know, having an idea, okay, what were the Redskins' chances of winning this week? That kind of thing off of that. But you know, not actual gambling. I mean, my first, like, I mean, I did NCAA tournament brackets. I ran some of those in high school, but I never, I think my first bet, and this is gonna be funny, I don't think I've ever said this, was in college. I think I found one of these online sites and deposited like $50 and like bet it, I don't know, lost a few bets or something, and then like put the rest of it on like, maybe a deposit more than $50. So I think I had a $50 bet, was maybe a sophomore year of high school, college, like on the Angels money line. And they were like a favorite. I was like, oh, they'll definitely win. They're better than this team or something. Like I was a total square. I had, there was no, nothing behind it. I was a baseball fan. This is like the Chone Figgins Angels days. And so that's my first exposure. Like when I moved to, when I talked my way into an internship at LVSC, and then that same summer before that, I worked for a professor doing a literature review on all the academic discourse in sports betting and how it pertains to financial markets. That's when I really started to, like, that was my real exposure to it and in a real meaningful way. And so that's kind of like, I mean, that summer was really instrumental in my life, I guess I could say.
When, and LVSC, for those who are unfamiliar,
Las Vegas Sports Consultants. They used to exist. It's the company that Roxy Roxborough started, the legendary Roxy Roxborough, back in the 1980s, I believe it was, and he sold it in, I think, 98, but the time Kenny White was running it, and he was part of a partnership group that owned it, but they set odds or recommended opening point spreads to 90% of the Nevada sports books. So it was like the way of the books outsourcing the odds making.
So do you remember, can you recall even one example of you're betting, you're a square, and then you join LVSC? Can you remember even one example where you had like an aha moment of like, oh, that's how you're supposed to do that?
So actually, I don't think I was a square when I joined LVSC because of all the academic, because literally reading through hundreds and hundreds of pages of like, of, you know, journal, well, peer reviewed, you know, academic articles on sports betting, like, you know, I understood the favorite long shot bias, the, you know, all these different things, right? Like the cold weather acclimatization effect. Like, I mean, there's all these, you know, the fact that, I mean, yeah.
So then in that process, then maybe backing up, when you're going through that process of reading all of this, can you remember a moment where your brain turned from thinking as an amateur, as we all start out on, to something clicking where you're like, oh, okay, I'm starting to get this.
Honestly, I think that happened to me when I took econometrics course in college. So it was before any of this, when I realized, oh, I can actually like answer these questions I've always had. Like I can do this type of now, I can figure out how much walks are worth and blah, blah, you know, that type of stuff. And that, I think that's what it kind of led me to Las Vegas into this. Right. I mean, and so it was more like I'd always had these questions and I just never knew how to answer them exactly.
So when you're at LVSC, like we hear about your time there, how did that contribute to the development of you as a better?
Oh, I absorbed so much knowledge and information and so much of the experience of the other guys in the office who had been doing this for, you know, I mean, I would say they'd all been there for 20, decades. You know, these guys had been around gambling like their whole lives and they took a different approach than I did. They were very good with numbers, but they were not academically trained statisticians. I mean, I'm not either, but they weren't, you know, I had more of a statistics background than anybody in the office did. But they thought about things in a certain way. And I think I learned from that. And I think I came in thinking that, you know, I could quantify everything, that numbers were everything. And I learned that I sort of learned about the limits of what you can do quantitatively. I got an appreciation of that and sort of the idea of like these angles you can find, sort of from the guys in the office. And just, I mean, it was great though. I mean, it was like academia for sports, really. I mean, you never knew what you were going to talk about, that like what kind of interesting conversation you were going to have, because it was a small office. It was basically an open-ish office. I wouldn't trade that year for anything.
Yeah. Now you're in Las Vegas. I know, you know, some other members of this community. I know Andy Molitor likes to throw dice. I know Jeff Ma appreciates a dice table from time to time. Okay, yeah. Did you ever like feel like you've been in Vegas, you know, for a while now? Do you enjoy anything like that? Or are you so focused on sports betting objectively? Like, do you ever enjoy like just the recreational side of gambling?
Not much. I mean, you know, when I play blackjack, I'll count cards. Although most of the time, if I'm playing blackjack, it's like with Zach White after the Super Bowl, and we're both really drunk and like thinking we can count cards but can't. But when I moved out to Vegas, I was playing more blackjack then. I was card counting. I was trying to build a bankroll the hard way. I was spreading like $5 to like $30 at the beginning, playing double deck blackjack at Sam's Town in the East Side Cannery. If this sounds depressing, it probably should, but at the time it was like, I don't know, at the time I was so motivated and I was like tracking absolutely everything in spreadsheets I wish I could sort of bottle that motivation I had back then and just like, you know, I think when you're young and hungry, there's something there. But in terms of like now, I don't really recreationally gamble. I play golf instead.
So you said something there that I actually resonate with, and so I'm going to jump on it now. You said when you're young and hungry, and something that I've noticed as I sit in my later 30s, that the drive and hunger that I had both in my, primarily in my vocation, which is away from gambling, and even in my desire to be good at my hobbies, is like feels like it's slowing down. I feel like I don't feel that motivation to burn the midnight oil or to push through the extra hours to get something done. At this point in your career, and I know we're jumping forward a little bit, but I don't want to miss that comment you made. Like, how does that and how does that apply to you and your vocation as a better?
Oh, it directly applies. And I feel the same way. It's, you know, I had this sort of single-minded pursuit of making it in this world when I moved out to Vegas, like being able, like, I remember thinking that there was a point, maybe it was like November of 2008. I'd been there for about 4 or 5 months and thinking that, you know what, if I lost my job, I could grind out like $35,000 a year here with this bank, like playing blackjack and betting on sports with this, you know? And to me, that felt like that felt like I had made it. Like I was like, cause in Vegas, like, I mean, I was also at a job that paid me $25,000 a year.
Right.
And I was renting a room in, with a, you know, that I found on Craigslist in the house of a rando who actually is one of my best friends now, that I was renting for, I think it was $450 or $500 a month. Right. Like things are very cheap in Las Vegas. So they were extremely cheap back then because you had the market crashing and everything. So I wanted to make it. And then later on after when I was betting for a living, I wanted to be like the best, you know, I wanted to just, there was just this, like, it was my everything in a way. And so, it certainly is not the case now, but there's still moments. Like I surprised myself last, Sunday night. And like, I was tired Sunday evening and I had to finish my handicapping for the PGA Championship. And I ended up like pushing through and actually I pulled like an all nighter. I was up till 7 AM. Cause markets started opening. And I was like, you know, and it reminded me that it's like, I still can do it if I need to for little short stretches. And it was kind of nice in that way. I was like, I remember when I used to pull all nighters like more regularly, just cause I was inspired by something.
Do you like, so what does motivate you then? Like you know, when it comes to betting, what continues, whether it's the inside the handicapping itself, in the results of it, in the experience, whatever it may be, you know, if the Rufus of a decade ago was motivated by wanting to be the best and being successful, like what motivated you to finish that handicapping ahead of the PGA Championship? Like what was it? Was it a feel obligation or was there still some fire there?
Certainly obligation, but I was going to say what motivates me now is mostly it's just inertia at this point. that sounds sad, but I think I'm less outcome driven now than I was. I'm not thinking about the outcome as much. I've become much more process driven in terms of what I value. And there's certain things I find joy in. Like I love the problem solving of sports betting, the challenge. It's like a puzzle. I love games. I love games in general. Like I'm not a gamer, like video games, but I love games. And so I think there is the game to sports betting still has appeal to me.
How has the way you apply your mind to sports betting impacted other areas of your life? Like, have you found that you're able to, like, did you discover a new hobby or like you mentioned games, like do you play tabletop games and like think in that way? Like, is there anything comparable to that?
I don't know, but sports betting has totally changed the way I look at the world, I guess I don't remember how I exactly looked at it back, you know, in 2007 before I got into this world. But the way I look at it now is much more, I think more nuanced. It's less black and white. It's certainly more Buddhist. I think I wouldn't have found Buddhism without gambling for that matter. And it's largely through the lens of probability and thinking about the process behind an outcome on a level that probably other people or that don't gamble probably don't always, or maybe they do. And I just never did before, but you know, like some person is trolling me on Twitter, you know, my thought there is like, well, why are they doing this? Like what's their process here? Right. And they're like, you know, they're probably not a super happy person. Like it's hard to be negative when you're like in angry. I don't know if they're actually angry. Maybe it's just a joke to them. I don't know. That's fine too. But you can't, it's hard to be happy when you're angry or when you're frustrated or when you're negative, I find. And so I'm like, well, you know, this is probably more about this other person than in the stuff that's going on in their life than it is about me. And so as a result, I don't try, like, I'm less likely to take it personally, and I'm more likely to feel a little bit of compassion for that person, you know? And I have people that, like, will troll me and then later message me or something, and I'll totally interact with them normally. Cause it's like, look, we all have our issues. We are very complicated people. And I think that, you know, just cause someone's an asshole to me once doesn't mean that, like, that person isn't a real human being that matters.
Look, I'm sure, I don't know if you're sick of talking about this yet or not, but I think it makes the best example for this next question. You posted a futures bet that you had for the recent golf tournament. It was a long shot to win a bunch of money, and you chose not to hedge. And that became, I think, like, other than gun control, it became the biggest discussion in America on whether or not Rufus Peabody should have hedged his bet.
It was just the biggest thing on your Twitter feed, which is like you get the big news story and then gambling.
Right. You clearly have a more objective and accepting view on your persona and your gambling success or habits being dissected by people in this community. But you've admitted that you haven't always been great at handling that or being able to accept that sort of criticism. Maybe using this example as an anchor point, or however you want to answer this, like, can you describe sort of the evolution you've gone in the growth you've had as a person who had to handle the fact that your success and reputation came with scrutiny, to being able to accept that in a more healthy way?
Well, first off, I think I always kind of craved recognition in a way that, like, maybe my partners didn't. It wasn't like I wanted to be famous or something like that, but I wanted acknowledgement for the things I was doing in a way. And you don't really get that in the sports betting world. Like, Zach White has always said, you know, I mean, that to me, like, recognition is more important than money. And to all of them, money was more important. Like, they could care less if anybody knew who they were. So that was kind of my starting point, I guess. And I think I've always been someone that's, I'm naturally a sharer. I mean, not like in the giving sense, but no, I mean, I don't have a lot of secrets. Kind of what you see is what you get. And I tend to be pretty open with people, even if they're fairly strangers. I don't know. So I think when I started having more of a public persona, which never really happened, I mean, it kind of gradually happened. There was Twitter and, like, doing some podcasts. And then I got asked to be on a panel at Sloan in 2016, which I was so freaking scared. Like, I literally took half a Xanax before it, 'cause that's how scared I was. I don't have a Xanax prescription. I actually had taken it once, but a week before. I was like, I'm going to be so scared. I need something. And my friend was like, here, you should try this. Like, I was like, well, I need to try it before, because what if I get on stage?
Right.
But, so there was that, like, that was my, but I'm digressing, but I guess, and then I did the ESPN stint. Right. And so I wasn't really used to, I started getting more engagement, I guess, and both positive and negative. And I think it happened gradually throughout, like, after I started posting the Massey Peabody ratings, you know, and all that stuff, like that's, you know, that sort of public journey started. But it was very difficult to just sit with, you know, negative things people would write about me, criticisms. And I would feel the need to, like, try to convince everybody that, no, they're wrong about me. I'm actually, like, a really nice guy and I'm right. Like, and so I think that the Buddhism thing certainly helped. And as did, like, you know, having a therapist, which, I mean, I feel like the reason I went to therapy is completely unrelated to that. But although I think everybody could benefit from therapy, but I had I still remember my therapist saying, it was like 3 weeks after meeting me in, like, 2017, something about how, in a way, I seek acceptance from others because there's some part of me that doesn't accept myself. And I was like,
no, of course, like, I really like myself. I'm like, no, you don't understand. And it was 6 months later, I was on a bus in Lisbon, from Lisbon to a soccer game. And I just had, like, I don't know why it struck me then, but I was like, I know what he means. It's like, if I can accept my own deficiencies, then nothing anybody else says has any power to hurt me. Like, I think when you're defensive and you're like, being defensive is really not good for your mental health. I don't think, at least it wasn't for me. If they say something negative towards me and it's like true, if they say, you know, you want recognition, or I don't know, I don't think that that's the case as much anymore. But
so something that I'm curious if you experience this as someone who is, you know, on the, there was a one point in my life where, and I don't think it was that long ago, and I'm sure it still stands in some capacity, but Gil was, if he was to make a short list of most successful bettors, he knows you made that list. So there's a wide gap in at least betting success here. But I think when it comes to vocational success, I think you and I are probably more similar than not. One thing that I've struggled with when it comes to an acceptance from either peers or even worse from potential audience or criticism by those similar groups of people is I fear that it could become a barrier to success or goals, right? And I've definitely felt that way when it comes to like brand building, like within the Better Life, like people, you know, like when I hear criticism of the podcast, I don't care about their thoughts on me or the podcast. I care that what they're saying could influence or somehow become an arbitrary barrier on whether or not I can get to the goal that I want to have for this endeavor. Does that at all sit, like, do you feel like you've ever experienced something like that?
You know, I think with the whole controversy the other weeks with the, I think that in that case, I felt the need to, like, I didn't want to hurt, like, unabated. I didn't want people, you know, and so I think I felt it there. I've never felt that really with, like, Bet the Process as much. I mean, hell, we had a guy pay 50 people, I think $20 each to give 1-star reviews for Bet the Process. If you look for, I think it's a day in like early November 2020, there's one day where we have like 51-star reviews. I'm like, Jeff couldn't get Apple to like cancel them. honestly, not really, because I've always just been like, what you see is what you get a little bit. But really quickly, I was going to finish, like, if someone criticizes me, like, and it's actually true, then, I mean, if I own it and say, hey, I'm really bad at this, then someone can't come and say, hey, Rufus, you suck at this. I'm like, I already said that. I know that. I'm working on it. Like, I'm not, right. You take ownership of it yourself, basically. And if someone says something that just is not true, then I don't know. Then they're not actually criticizing me. They're criticizing some idea they have of me. But I think the hardest is when someone says something that there may be truth to, but you are resisting, that you haven't admitted to yourself. That's the hardest. And so I think it comes from just, and so I think what's helped me is I guess like just, I think growing as an individual and understanding myself better and rather than sort of resisting this, know the truth about myself, like being open to it, even if it's not always, you know, sunshine and rainbows and unicorns and flowers.
When you realized, I don't know how aware you were of it when it was originally going on, or if it was a part of, you know, introspectiveness or whatever, but when you realized that you were yearning for recognition, stuff like that, who do you think was the top audience that you were yearning for recognition from? Was it your peers? Was it from people in the space that you respect? Was it just from the average Twitter user? Like, who do you feel like would have given you the most validation had you gotten the recognition from them?
I think early in my career, I think I wanted to kind of prove to the people, like I think going to Yale, I never had a roommate who was dumber than me. Like, I was always the dumbest one, and at least that's how what I thought. And there's so many really smart people and brilliant people there. And I think towards the end, I finally found something I was good at and really enjoyed and pursued, right? And that was sort of the sports analytics stuff. And so I think in a way, like, I wanted to prove by my success that, like, you know, to these people in a way, to my peer, like, that had been my peers, that I was good enough. What was the rest of the question?
Essentially, who do you feel like if at the, when recognition was maybe at its, like, when the desire for recognition was maybe at its strongest for you, who do you feel like could have given you the most validation in that moment? Whether person or people or type of person?
I don't know. I think it's people that I respected in the industry, right? I think the respect of, like, people whom I respect is important. I think that still is. I mean, I think that's signals that I'm doing something that's right. Like, the fact that, like, I'm friends with, like, Roxy, and that, like, is, to me, means a lot. Like, the friendships, the relationships I've made in this industry mean a ton to me.
So without asking you to, like, name names or anything, I am when I heard you become more public about admitting that you were sort of trying to overcome your ego, your desire for recognition, et cetera, you were considered one of the most respected bettors among people who I respect. And so I'm curious, where do you think the disconnect was? Like, where, so you have Tim Lawson, who is an average bettor who listens to, you know, that listens to the Gil Alexanders and Drew Dinsicks and everything of the world, the Preston Johnsons of the world, these people that everybody else respects, they all respect Rufus Peabody. Therefore, I respect Rufus Peabody. Yet I'm watching Rufus talk about the desire for recognition. Where do you think the disconnect was on your ego being satisfied from the recognition that we as average bettors were seeing you get? Oh,
your ego is never going to be satisfied. That's the thing.
Okay.
So that's why you have to that's what you realize. Like, the more recognition you get, the more you want recognition. The more money you make, the more you want money. I mean, it's, have you ever read or listened to, I guess, the David Foster Wallace's This Is Water commencement speech? I think it was to, like, Kenyon College.
You know, I'm sure that sounds familiar. I'm sure someone has recommended it to me, but I don't recall it. So I may have not seen it.
That's fantastic.
Okay. You know,
one fish says to the other as it swims by, "Hey, how's the water?" And he's like, "What's water?" But later, that's not what I was, the part of the speech I was referring to, but he says that in life, there's no such, you can't, in life, everybody worships the altar of something, right? Whether it's, you know, whether it's money, you never have enough. There'll always be someone richer, right? If it's power, you want more. If it's your beauty, you die 1,000 deaths as you age. In a way, like, religion may be the least harmful. So it's, I think if it's recognition, I mean, I realized that, like, you know, it's like social media, right? It can become a drug in a way. And, it's about, like, and it's empty. It is. I realized I was less happy, and it is more stressful. And, you know, I think as you gain more of a following, you're going to gain more people that dislike you and try to bring you down too. You know, there's people that are jealous. There's people that just flat don't like me, that I rub them the wrong way. Hell, I know. I've known that for a long time. Like, in high school, teachers either loved or hated me, because I was the person that asked, always wanted to know what my grade was, so I knew how hard I had to work. I always wanted the lowest possible A. That was winning. So for me, it was just, it's about finding, I mean, happiness is inside. And so that's, and yeah. And some, it, when you're checking your Twitter and, like, how many likes did this get? For me, it was never like how many likes, but it's,
I don't know, if you're constantly judging yourself by how other people judge you, you're saying you have no control of your happiness. So what I mean, because if you're saying you want recognition, you're saying that this makes me happy, right? That I believe that if people say nice things about me, then that is going to make me happier. But there's the flip side of that is if people don't, then I'm going to be less happy. And so you're saying you have no control over it, because I don't have control over how people react to things I do. All I can do is just be myself and do the best I can and let the chips fall where they may. And so I am my harshest critic, and I have to satisfy myself. And that's, you know, if I can do that, then what other people think doesn't really matter to me. Again, I still value the relationships I have in the industry and things like that, and friendships. But the idea of, I don't know, exploding and gaining a huge following doesn't hold the same appeal to me at this point. In fact, like, there's times when I kind of wish I could just, you know, think about like deleting Twitter and just being kind of like anonymous again, because I mean, I am anonymous in the real world. Gambling world is a very, very small one, but
I have a of course, you know, I use the Better Life primarily, but I have a personal Twitter account that I only use for customer service. Like, I don't use it for tweeting, I don't use it for anything else other than to DM companies that I need customer service from, because oddly, unfortunately, and it's, you know, world we're in, I can get better responses out of their social media customer service than I can trying to call a hotline or something like that. So I felt the same way you did. I was like, I just want to get rid of my Twitter account, and realized, yeah, but it's been convenient when I need to reschedule a flight.
Well, I think you get to choose how you use it. I'll go through periods where I don't tweet for a few weeks or a month, or like, basically, you know, maybe I'll retweet something here and there, but I don't really use it. And then there's times like where I'll tweet like 10 times in a day or something, right? It's just, if that's what I'm doing that day. But I don't feel like I need to check it all the time, which is nice.
So applying mental health more as like a discipline, stoicism, however you want to frame it, to the actual activity of sports betting, one of my favorite tweets from you, and one that I recall on each time I have a really bad day in betting, is you admitted to having like some 0-20 or 12 or some 0-and really bad day in the NFL, but it was your best NFL season to date, if I'm recalling the tweet correctly.
Maybe I think it was probably baseball, where I went like 0-12 one day.
Okay. Maybe it was baseball. Okay.
I think so.
Yeah.
And it might have been football. I don't know. I certainly know that I've had big offers in baseball.
Yeah. And how have you always been able to be objective about the swings of betting, or was it a development or exercise to not let variance impact the way that you handle the next slate or the next set of games?
So I don't let it affect the way I handle the next slate. It can affect me emotionally. Betting baseball was such a grind for me. It was mentally very taxing, because I feel like so much of my self-worth used to be tied up in baseball, because it's like, it's how I got started. I mean, I wrote my senior thesis on it. You know, it's like, if I'm not good enough at this anymore, then like, you know, who am I? And that's one reason I'm not betting baseball anymore, to be honest, because it was so hard for me mentally. So the swings can affect you, I think. But in the moments, for sure. Like, I'm not a robot, but it doesn't affect my process in terms of betting. I mean, I think what has always helped me out is when things are going well, that's when I tend to sweat things more. Like, I'll follow the games. I'll follow the golf tournament when it's going well for me. If things are going poorly, I get away from it. And so I think that's kind of helped me. I think it's helped too that for a lot of my career, I haven't been actually the one putting in the bets myself. So I think having that separation helps for sure. But when I do, I do notice, like, let's say there's a marginal edge. If I'd been winning bets and running well, then I'd be more inclined to take that marginal edge, versus if I'm running poorly, I'm trying to find a reason not to bet.
taking a little bit of a step back and just looking at going back to sort of your story of being a sports bettor, how did, if at all, did legalization like impact Rufus Peabody as a sports bettor?
It certainly impacted me. I mean, it created there's a new market, new markets, I should say. There's a wide variety of different opportunities that's presented. So it's impacted me in that way. I mean, like I've had, you know, find betting partners and that kind of thing. It's made things logistically tougher for sure. But that's, you know, because there's opportunities. So, you know, it's helped for sure, I think. But
you mentioned Zach White a couple of times. We had we were fortunate to hang out with Zach White down Biloxi ahead of Bet Bash. Zach hung out with us for a couple of days down there, and
that's a fun guy. He's a good guy.
Yeah, we played some golf. I know my buddy Rob went to the casino with him and played some craps and whatnot with him.
Did you go to the fill-in station? That's where he always goes. I know.
I know they went. I didn't. I had to run up to something else, but I know that he and a group of people did go to the filling station. But when it comes to, so I talked to Richard Munchkin about this last week. When it comes to networking and especially betting partnerships, people you work with.
So there was a guy back in 2010 in Colorado that I had become friends with. He was actually the first person outside of work who I met in the betting world in Las Vegas back in 2008. And he came on like he was going to be our fifth partner. He's a really, really smart guy, engineering background, like good baseball better, like just AP type guy. And he, after like 3 or 4 weeks, I think he said, I can't really do this. Like the, you know, you guys are all workaholics. And I don't have that same kind of motivation. And also like, you know, the swings are just like a lot. And so he, you know, that wasn't right for him. I think if you let this stuff affect you, let the ups and downs affect you, you're not going to, I mean, it's not an industry you're going to really choose just because you won't be happy. You'll be too stressed out. And I think everybody goes through, when they get in this, a sort of acclimatization period, a learning curve where you sort of learn how to lose and learn how to deal with the swings, the ups and the downs. And then you kind of become a lot more numb to it, and it becomes easier. And I do think you gain a lot of insight and perspective from gambling for a living that you probably don't in other careers. So, but no, we've never had anybody like go off the deep end and like place a bunch of bad bets or anything like that. I mean, there's always, you know, mistakes happen and stuff like that, but like,
yeah. Like when your family learned that you were going to bet professionally, how much context did they have into your knowledge and understanding of it? And what was their initial response? And how does that look now?
They were always very supportive of me. I learned to read the baseball box scores before I learned to read, I think. So I was they always knew that like sports and the numbers side of sports were just like a huge thing for me and a part of me. And they always supported that. And so like, I'm extremely lucky. I have the most amazing family, and they were supportive. I think I remember the advice my dad gave me was just don't make sure you're not going towards a dead end. Right. So yeah. As long as I'm building something, like, also the thing is I was always kind of an entrepreneur. In like in high school, I would mow lawns. I would shovel snow when it snowed. Like I always hustled. I refereed youth soccer. I umpired Little League baseball. You know, there was one summer in college where I had three jobs basically. Like I think they always thought I'd be fine financially because I would be okay in that regard. And I think that the fact that I gambled for a living in a way, even though I could say I was somewhat like on the financially risk averse side. I think it made sense to them.
And what about in like dating and relationships? Has the gambling aspect of it been challenging to to communicate to potential partners, or have you had such an entrepreneurial sort of angle to it that it looks more like a business and less like you're a gambler?
It is a business. So right. It's never been a challenge. I do remember one first date I went on in Washington, D.C. back in maybe like 2013 or 2014, where when the person found out I was a gambler, they said, I want nothing to do with you. Sorry. Like maybe they have, but I think if someone has maybe gambling problems in their family or something like that, then it could trigger them. So
yeah,
I get that. But I think if when someone actually understands me, then they're fine with that. And I'm not going to be in a relationship with someone who doesn't fundamentally understand who I am.
I only laugh because I imagine like, well, like, where does the conversation go from there? You're just like, okay, well, it's nice to meet you. You want to flip a coin to see who pays the bill?
I don't even remember. I think she might have texted me immediately after because I thought the date was wrong. She was like, I'm sorry.
Can't do it.
I was like, no, you don't understand.
I was looking forward to everything we've discussed. I know there's a couple more questions focused more just on you as a better and that process that I want to get to and that my audience is interested in. Cut your teeth and made your heyday in baseball, but I think a lot of people now recognize you as a very successful golf better. What was the aha moment on realizing that golf was where you wanted to focus?
I don't think it was one aha moment. I first started with golf in 2009, and that's because one of my partners had data on that, and was doing some betting. And I was like, "Hey, let me take a look at that." And I found that I, you know, could approach it in a more systematic way. And so we started really firing on other types of markets too than just, you know, a few matchups. And so it kind of went from there, and it quickly became the very profitable for us, and it has continued to be profitable. And so I think that's been the biggest thing. And I also love golf, and I think betting on golf has kind of made me love golf even more and play it, be more, you know, inclined to play it. And so it's kind of been sort of a virtuous cycle in a way. And I think that, as markets mature, and I fundamentally believe that markets tend toward efficiency in general, financial markets, betting markets. And so it's gotten harder to win at four sports, doing them all or pretty well, I guess, because you can't, you know, if I spent all my time on one sport, I could do it better than if I'm dividing it. Like that's just reality. Yeah. I think you could say that about anything. You know, the more attention you devote to something, the better you can be at it. So the bar keeps getting higher to be profitable and to at least profitable enough to make it worth your while, just across the board, I think, just as markets get more efficient and analytics becomes a bigger part of sports betting. I mean, back when I did my senior thesis, you could win betting baseball just using sabermetrics basically. And now, in a way, that might be overpriced in.
Right.
So, you know, so I think golf, in a way, was like the last man standing, or it was the thing where I realized that, I mean, it's my biggest edge, and I kind of see the writing on the wall and the fact that I can't do absolutely everything well, and so it's the thing I've choose to specialize in the most. And you know, I no longer bet baseball, and you know, at some point, maybe I'll stop betting football to the same extent. I mean, I still will probably bet it somewhat just because I enjoy watching it. but it certainly isn't like baseball, but football is right now such a small percentage of what I make that, you know, it doesn't, in a way, it doesn't merit as much time as golf does. And then in a way, I don't want to say I fall further behind, but, you know, if you're not constantly evolving, then you are falling behind. I firmly believe that in any of these markets. And so yeah, I will eventually be falling far enough behind in football that I probably shouldn't be betting it. We'll see when that happens.
Rufus, this has been an absolute pleasure. I feel like I could go on and on and on with more nuanced questions and and whatnot. But I think my final question for you, if you're willing to be a little vulnerable here and speak to, not that you haven't been, but I'm going to ask you to peel one more layer back. This is Mental Health Awareness Month. You have spoken about the importance of mental health and especially therapy on Twitter. Without talking about like what got you there, all that, we don't need to hear that part of your life, but like just the benefit you've had from therapy and why you advocate for people to at least give it a try for their own personal benefit.
You know, for me, I think the two things that have had the biggest impact are therapy. Actually, I think therapy is number two behind Buddhist classes and Buddhist philosophy. That's actually, I think, helped me probably more than therapy has. Why? I mean, I think it's about understanding yourself. And like, look, you have this one life, depending on what religion you believe in, I guess you have one life, but it can be heaven or hell, right? And so it's about figuring yourself out and how to sort of be happy, because if you're not happy, then like you should try something different. Like, don't keep trying the same thing and expecting that somehow things are going to change. So I think it's really just about growing as a person and trying to understand yourself and what makes you tick and brings you joy. So I mean, what got me there, I guess, to therapy, there was, I guess, this was what, early 2016 when I first tried to find a therapist, just because I'd had a relationship end in a way that was like, that made me kind of reevaluate some things, I guess, or realize that I need to work on myself. And so, and the funny thing, and it's obviously therapy has been helpful in so many different ways, though. So I just had a Zoom meeting with my therapist today.
Good.
Yeah.
Yeah. Rufus, Bet the Process, unabated, at Rufus Peabody. I don't need to tell anybody where to find you, because the people who know who you are know where to find you. I look forward to, look, I'm an unabated subscriber. I enjoy the Discord chats. I enjoy the tools and whatnot. I hope to have
you. Oh, you said unabated. I thought you said, in my head, you're talking about the process. I was like, wait, we have a Discord?
Sorry, no.
Yeah, no, unabated, yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you for your support, seriously.
Yeah, you're welcome. And I hope maybe before the ramp up to NFL season gets too busy for everybody, maybe you and Captain Jack can come together and maybe talk to my audience a little bit about why recreational bettors looking to become more serious about betting can use unabated to get them there.
I'd love that. And by the way, if you haven't checked out the hedging tool we debuted today, you should give it a look. I wrote an accompanying article. I actually am quite proud of that. We put it together in 2 days, and I literally had to relearn a little bit of calculus to build it. But I think it's pretty awesome.
Very good. Well, I will check that out. I will. I've retweeted the article and the tool, so people have seen it in their feed. And Rufus, I look forward to doing this again. Let's not wait another like 2-3 years to finally get this together.
I agree.
That was an absolute pleasure to record. Those discussions are important, and I appreciate Rufus's perspective and willingness to be a little vulnerable in spots. So thanks again for Rufus for doing that. A couple admin notes before I wrap up sort of my thoughts on mental health awareness and why it was important to me to do these string of episodes. Vegas vacation coming up in just, 2 weeks. Oh, wow, 2 weeks from tomorrow. That's crazy. Yes, I will be in Vegas for Vegas vacation. I will be at pretty much all of the social events. I will be in Vegas on the 11th. I'm sort of hanging out on my own, doing what I need to do, and then maybe hanging out with some friends later that evening. And then it's Vegas vacation. Likely my last Vegas trip this year, due to some family developments and things that are happening professionally, etc. So, I mean, I will have less hidden or less cryptic explanation of what that looks like later. But for now, that's what's going on. And so I am so excited to get out there, see people, and enjoy what may be my last trip to the desert in probably the next year. So looking forward to that. And I think that's it. Bettermerch.com, Patreon.com/TheBetterLife. Two ways that you can support the show. Use promo code YO11 in the shop for 11% off of your purchase. Every Patreon supporter has access to the monthly shows with Mr. Rosenthal. And I saw a bunch of you hopped on recently for that and seem to have enjoyed the first iteration of those episodes. So appreciate that. Mental Health Awareness Month. It's important to me. I have suffered, earlier in life I suffered. Now I just sort of deal with episodes of depression. And it's something that I'm very aware of it now. Whereas before I just sort of like drudged through it. Now I'm very aware of it. I can almost how like when you feel like a tickle in your throat and you kind of feel a cold coming on, I can almost feel an episode come on in that same way. Those don't happen quite as often as they used to, which is very, very good. I struggle sometimes with a pessimistic view on the world and on humans and on myself. And so that is something that I work through a lot. And being a gambler, I know the liability that not being disciplined and focused and sort of in the right mindset can have while gambling. And so I wanted to do these episodes coming in May, starting with taking a week off, realizing, okay, I'm stressing out. That was actually inadvertent, but it just happened to work out for the sort of theme of the month. The first week of May, I was stressed and I was feeling sort of the pressure of getting an episode out and then worried what I was going to do. And then realized, you know what? I'm just going to take the week off. And it worked out. Great conversations with Gil and then Richard Munchkin. And then of course, Rufus Peabody here on this episode. Look, I'm just going to be honest. I'm embarrassed to say how recent my, last suicidal thought was. I still struggle with mental health from a personal health standpoint. The doubt and self-loathing that one person can experience is miserable, and I understand and I know that it is far too real with a lot more people than are willing to admit. Therapy is a very powerful thing when you find the right therapist. It's okay to try therapy, realize that this person's not working for me, and try something else. Just because therapy doesn't work once doesn't mean it can't work. It's all about sort of a relationship that you have there with your therapist. Finding a support system is huge. That is something that I have found in this community. I'm not going to start listing all the names out of fear of missing one. But of all the people you hear me say, my good friend, my close friend, my best friend, my better half, those are people that I trust with thoughts far beyond what I'm doing at the casino. And they are people that I discovered because of this community. And one of the reasons that I hold this community so dear is because I've made those relationships, I've made those connections, and they've been invaluable to who I am as a human being now. So thank you so much for listening. Thank you so much for entrusting me with this subject. A lot of you have commented that you've enjoyed this series. I'm sure some of you maybe could do without some of this stuff, and that's fine too. It's not for everybody, but it was important to me, and I know it's important to a lot of people, so I wanted to see this through, and I think Rufus was the right person to sort of to bookend this three-run series. So next week, coming back with another gambler, talking gambling, doing gambling things. Hope everybody does well. Enjoy your nice long weekend. Good luck with all your bets. On behalf of Rufus Peabody, I am Timothy Lawson. Good night and good luck.